It's Wednesday, October the 7th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Joining me today, Irish Times Managing Editor and Economic Savant, Cliff Taylor, Political Editor, Pat Leahy, and our political reporter, Jennifer Bray. Jen, I'm going to go to you first, because yesterday Pat and myself went through the clash between the government and the National Public Health Emergency Team over whether or not to move to level 5 of the Living with COVID plan or to just move to level 3. So we don't need to rehearse all that again, but what developments have there been since then? I was reading your excellent Irish Times Politics Digest, which landed in my inbox this morning. I recommend all our listeners to sign up for that. And you were writing, among other things, about a Fine Gael meeting last night.
Yeah, so yesterday, I suppose, was the aftermath of those comments that Leo Varadkar made on Clyburne on Monday night. And, you know, people were kind of really digesting what he'd said and thinking over the ramifications and wondering about the next steps, I suppose. And the focus, well, certainly the message that was coming out from government and from spokespeople to journalists was that it was time to put any squabbles aside. It was time to move on. It was Ireland versus the virus, and there was no time for any other conflict. So, you know, a lot of yesterday was sort of digging around and seeing what moves were afoot. And I think Tony Holohan was spotted wandering into government building shortly after lunchtime. Leo Varadkar coincidentally left around 2 minutes later, but it's a total coincidence. But he was in there to meet with Martin Fraser, Secretary General of the Department of Taoiseach. And like, I understand that meeting was to, I suppose, smooth over some of the issues that had arisen and find a path forward. It is interesting to note, though, I think that all throughout yesterday, none of the men and women, the wonderful spokesmen and women of the different government parties, would tell us why Tony Holohan was in the building. In fact, they said they didn't know, that he wasn't meeting the Taoiseach and he wasn't meeting the Taoiseach, and nobody in health knew and nobody in Taoiseach knew. So it struck me that maybe they wanted to keep this a little bit quieter. But of course, there's journalists floating around everywhere and you can't keep something like that quiet. So regardless of that, I think, you know, later in the evening, Fine Gael had a parliamentary party meeting and there was a lot came up at it, to be honest with you. There was a lot of interesting comments. Leo Varadkar started off by saying that, you know, just despite his previous comments, that this idea of a circuit breaker lockdown can't actually be ruled out. Now, he had kind of said a version of that on Clyburne, but I think it was the timing and the way he said it that it could be inevitable, regardless of the decision not to go ahead with it at this stage. He also talked about enforcement around restrictions, but there was another kind of interesting conversation. It was quite broad and it was about the National Public Health Emergency Team, and it was about the structures, how they report, the governance and ways in which this can be, I suppose, avoided in future. And the former Minister for Housing, Owen Murphy, gave a lengthy enough presentation where he talked about this idea of using the National Emergency Coordination Group, which most of our listeners will probably know is actually normally used in terms of severe weather events. Now, it is constituted, it can be used for other, you know, it can be used for other major events like terrorism or anything major that might arise in the course of whatever is happening. So, you know, he was talking about how you'd have a lead department, you'd have the advisory body, which in terms of weather events would be Met Éireann, in this instance would be the NPHET, and then you'd have different departments. And like, the aim of this basically would be that everybody is in the same room, that when they're talking about, we're going to recommend X, that a different department, let's say it was education, could turn around and say, okay, this means we have to close the schools. How long do we have to close the schools for? Or justice could say, okay, that means we need enforced Garda patrols. How much money, how much Garda overtime will this cost? And in the round, it could be worked out. Like, what he's basically talking about is getting everybody into a room together under a structure which has already been established and which has been proven, I suppose, to work quite well. And I understand that idea had a broad welcome, and it is something they'll have to look at, because we know from Leo Varadkar's comments on Clyburne that, as he put it himself, this won't happen again. There won't be a repeat of what happened on Sunday night, where the public is bombarded with this message of a level 5 and there's alarm and panic and fear. So that was kind of the gist of last night. And, you know, we sort of have more details coming out this morning about stuff that was said during the meeting. I think Patrick O'Donovan, the Fine Gael Minister of State for the OPW, said raised the idea of off licenses and curtailing the hours that people can access off license, but also the potentially the amount of alcohol that they can consume. And as you can imagine, it's Ireland, it's topic of alcohol, it will get people talking. And most of the reaction has been negative, because if people will find a way to get their hands on booze, no matter what you do, if you want to, you know, do a cut-off limit, people will stockpile, you know. I think there's been a bit of backlash to that, but I would say watch that space. But that's kind of the gist of where we're up to. But there was finally another meeting today with the between the Chief Medical Officer, Tony Holohan, and Micheál Martin. And Micheál Martin was kind of, I wouldn't say glowing in his praise of him, the Dáil, this afternoon, but kind of praised sort of his selfless contribution to Ireland during the pandemic. And to me, that struck a note of, let's move past this now.
So there's a bit of oil being poured on troubled waters there. Pat, one of the things that struck me reading Jen's report this morning about Owen Murphy's comment about the National Emergency Coordination Group, that rang a bell with me, and I threw those words into the Irish Times search bar. And the person who came up several times was our esteemed columnist Fintan O'Toole, who ever since early April has been asking this question, that this group, which is not just there, as Jen says, for weather emergencies, is there for terrorist attacks. It's supposed to be there for all form of emergencies, but for some reason, when we had the biggest emergency possibly in the history of the state, it was decided that no, this was too big an emergency for the National Emergency Coordination Group. So it's interesting to hear it's finally going to be taken out of mothballs.
Yeah, I had a feeling you were going to make reference to that. All right, Hugh. I'm not sure it's entirely going to be taken out of mothballs, frankly. I think it was a suggestion at the Fine Gael parliamentary party that was warmly received, but I don't get any sense from government that the that there is going to be a reconstitution of that group, which is, you know, much larger, I suppose, in terms of not necessarily larger than NEFID, which is a large group that many people around government think should be slimmed down. But to bring in the, you know, to bring in the input from a whole variety of other departments and agencies into the decision-making process, I'm not sure that is necessarily on the cards. A much bigger emergency committee, it seems to me, is not necessarily a recipe for greater efficiency in policy making and implementation. In fact, it might turn out to be quite the opposite.
Can I actually, just channeling Fintan a little bit here, just make the counter argument, which is that this group didn't come out of nowhere. It was the product of several years of consultation and research papers and checking out what was necessary for the state to be ready to deal with emergencies. And then the first time a real big emergency comes along, it just gets junked because it's too big?
Well, I mean, I suppose, you know, if you were looking at the advent of various, you know, storms in recent years, you might call them emergencies as well. After all, you know, schools were closed, people were told not to go to work and so forth. But very much so, those were of a different order to a pandemic that has, you know, certainly isn't going to pass within a short period of time, as the storms inevitably were. So, I mean, I think you're right, and needless to say, Fintan is right about the unanswered questions as to what happened to the state's emergency plan. My scepticism at the moment is that the NEFID government axis is going to be completely redrawn with the insertion of another broader emergency group at this stage. I do think that there are probably changes on the way in the way that NEFID and its advice are transferred to government, how that advice subsequently becomes, you know, plans for the implementation of measures and of policies. But I'm not sure we're looking at something like that. In any event, I think, you know, I'm not sure how much public interest there really is in the, you know, in the detail of the architecture that the state has employed to deal with this crisis. I think they expect government to get advice from relevant experts and to act quickly on it. Of course, they also expect that advice to be correct, and they expect it to be capable of being acted upon in a timely manner by government. And that's one of the reasons why I think that there is very significant concern around government about the breakdown of recent days. Not that Tony Holohan's feelings will be hurt or anything like that, but that ultimately it damages the state's response to the changing conditions of the pandemic, and therefore that hampers attempts to overcome it and return us to normality.
Cliff, I suspect Pat is right when he says most people aren't that interested in the inner workings and structures of government agencies and departments as long as they get the job done. However, I'd say our listeners are quite interested in those kinds of subjects by definition. And it does seem to me that, you know, the media to some extent always frames these things as just personal clashes between one or two, in this case Tony Holohan and the government. But what it did illustrate was the fact that that isn't a very good system at this stage of the game, where what happened on Sunday night could happen. And it does call for better structures, better systems, better mechanisms, all that boring but important stuff.
Yeah, I think that's fair, Hugh. I think that the wider context to this, of course, is important too, and it's that we're kind of lost in our response to this virus, you know, and so are most other countries across Western Europe. We had kind of hoped we could mumble on for a few months, keep most of the economy open, and still keep the virus under control. And it's kind of clear now that that's going to be very difficult to do, that as soon as you start to reopen, the virus comes back. And not only does it come back, but it comes back with a vengeance. So I think what you saw last weekend in terms of the economy and in terms of the business response, you know, there was obviously fury in government buildings and a lot of angst and a lot of arguments over the phase five recommendation. There was huge angst in the business community as well. And you could say, that was a 24-hour thing. But I think it did bring up this question for businesses of where we're going over the next few months. So in the short term, even at level of three, most of the hospitality industry now is in real trouble. The Taoiseach was saying in the Dáil today that he expects 50,000 people to go back on the PUP, the pandemic unemployment payment, over the next couple of days. So that's bringing it from 200 back to 250. Had we gone to level five, you could have multiplied that. A couple of 100,000 people at least would have been straight back on the PUP. So it does seem, in terms of the what you're talking about and the nature of the response, that we do need some way to mediate those different arguments a bit better and to find a way through them. I don't know what that is. And, you know, one of the difficulties is that there may just not be an easy way through it. And perhaps we are heading for another wider lockdown. But it has certainly changed the backdrop to the budget coming up next week, because I think one of the key messages that Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath wanted to try and sell, if you like, next week, or put across to try and underpin confidence next in the economy, was that, look, we can in some way manage to live with this. We can keep the economy largely open. We can put in place the necessary supports when things have to close, maybe at phase three for periods of time. But now the fear has risen that, you know, phase three may not be enough. We may be looking at phase four and phase five. And in terms of the economy, the difference between three and four is the really important one. Because at phase three, most of the economy is open, with the exception of the hospitality industry and the events people, and which have been closed all, the latter of which have been closed all along. At phase four, you're talking, as things now stand in the government plan, of closing a huge extra part of the economy. All the non-essential retail sector closes, the construction sector closes, a part of the manufacturing sector closes. You're back in economic terms to where you were during the lockdown. And I think grappling with that now in the months ahead is going to be really difficult, and it's a really difficult backdrop for the budget next Tuesday.
And I want to ask you a little bit more in a minute about the budget, Cliff. But first, actually, Jen, could I ask you, one of the extraordinary things about this year, it seems to me, is that we're only 6 days away from the budget. Usually it would be absolutely the key, the only subject of conversation and debate publicly and in the political sphere. I have no idea what's going on with the budget beyond the huge challenges which Cliff just mentioned there. Is there any sense of the usual kind of haggling? Somebody's up, somebody's down, somebody's pushing for something, somebody's out of sorts, any of that kind of stuff going on?
Not really. I mean, I think this year, just from different ministers that I've spoken to, the bilaterals have been a little bit of a damp squib. I mean, previously you'd be bartering over larger amounts of sums, but now, like I'm told, it's arguments over between 5 million and 10 million here and there. And like ministers have been told that really the focus is Brexit, COVID and climate change to a lesser degree, but climate change factors into that. They're the main things. And when you look at the amount of money that is going, firstly, that's going to have to be put aside for measures that are already committed to. And when you look at money that will be needed next year, I mean, I think the last time we were on here, we were talking about how Michael McGrath said, you know, around 9 billion would be needed in extra COVID expenditure next year. Now it's looking like that could be significantly more. And, you know, that is the reality of the situation. There isn't much room for manoeuvre. And that means that there aren't much aren't many kites been flown. This time of year, normally you'd see, you know, talk about €5 for pensioners or welfare increases or maybe perhaps small changes to tax bans. But you're not going to see any of that this year. I mean, I think that there won't be any major changes in terms of the tax structure for ordinary citizens, and any kind of other changes in terms of welfare will be small and they'll be targeted just like they have been in previous years. So, you know, we're in a different reality. The other thing as well is that the government are currently trying to get a handle on what exactly the long-term forecasts are for the economy. And that's really, really hard to do. So I think in this budget, they'll probably break with tradition and it'll be a short forecast, probably for around a year. And that doesn't give much certainty. I know we're in a position where there isn't much budgetary certainty, but I know people always say it and it's a phrase totally overused, but it is unprecedented territory. So what I'm saying, in long story short, is that there isn't that much squabbling. I mean, there's always a surprise or two, and it's always interesting to see how they raise revenue through tax measures. So we'll keep an eye on that.
Last year, Pascal Donoghue was in a particular position as we were at the height of the Brexit crisis as it stood just then, to basically do what he wanted to do and not to succumb to the kind of the various sectoral pressures which always happen in the run-up to a budget. And I think he probably got some praise on that, for not from all quarters obviously, but from some quarters as well. And here he is again in an even bigger crisis, with Brexit looming again, of course, and then added to, multiplied in fact, by the pandemic. He really can't, Jen is right, is he? He really can't plan further ahead than 12 months. We might be in a situation in 12 months. I was just listening to a New York Times podcast before we came on air, in which a previously very bleak prophet of what was going to happen with COVID was saying there was a very good chance that things would have wound down and be coming to an end by this time next year. So you have to kind of allow for that contingency, as well as perhaps other much more bleak ones.
Yeah, I mean, it's near impossible, Hugh. You're right. And Jen is exactly right, that they won't come forward with any long-term forecasts. And really, it would be a nonsense to do that. So we get a forecast for 2021. That'll be it. We had been promised a long-term national economic plan to be published with the budget. That's not going to happen now. There'll be some kind of longer-term plan, I understand, published in November, but the really kind of serious one with the numbers in it isn't going to come till at least next spring. And you've got to say that against the, you know, you could say, okay, they're putting off the hard decisions, they're putting off the rows, they're putting off the decisions on how to pay for all the things they promised in the programme for government. And maybe to an extent they are. But really, against the backdrop of the kind of uncertainty you're talking about, you know, you just can't. Even before we talk about COVID, Brexit is probably a 2% swing one way or the other in economic growth next year. That's pretty huge. Before you even start out, and then COVID is even COVID will have an even bigger impact, and you're right, you know, listening to the WHO were saying last night maybe there might be a viable vaccine by the end of this year. Somebody else will say tomorrow night that there won't be one till 2023, and you know, you're probably better off asking Sam McConkie or Luke O'Neill than an economist for a forecast at this stage, because we just don't know. And
I'd say they wouldn't mind giving you one, actually, if you ask them.
They wouldn't mind giving you one. No, this is true, all right. But what's at stake in the middle of this is the whole consumer-facing part of the Irish economy. So even if you think of kind of the decisions that Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath have to make, you're looking at how to help the hospitality sector, for example. So do you assume that we will still have a hospitality sector, say, by the end of next year, which will be something like the one we all used to enjoy before the pandemic came in. You know, that we could go out for a drink, you go to a hotel, you could drop in and, you know, meet people, arrange to meet people. Or will the virus still be with us and we're looking at a whole new kind of structure for these industries? What about travel? You know, will people be back traveling, back on their holidays next year? Again, that impacts how you help the aviation sector, the travel sector, all that. So really difficult things. And I think the bottom line in terms of the budget is we're going to see a lot of money put aside in a contingency fund, a recovery fund, whatever they call it, but not allocated. So this, there'll be a big bag of money and they say, look, this is for COVID and Brexit. Whether it'll be one bag of money or two bags of money, I don't know. But there'll be a lot of money put aside, but it won't be allocated. It's likely to be needed. It may well be needed, but we don't know how or when it will be needed yet. And let's hope some of it may not be needed.
And so say all of us, but Pat, because in a situation where you might have, let's say, two very different scenarios 1 year from now, you really, from an economic planning point of view, you have to put your money on trying to sustain those parts of the economy which are currently in a deep freeze, sustain them for as long as possible in the hope or expectation that there will be a world for them to return to, the restaurants, the bars, the hotels, the venues, the gigs, the concerts, the cinemas, all the things which are shut down certainly for probably most of the winter.
Yes, but as Cliff says, you don't know what that's going to look like when you come out the far side of the pandemic. So if the size of the hospitality industry is X, then when you come out of the pandemic, whether it's next summer or summer 12 months after that, the size of the hospitality industry is going to be, you know, X divided by 2 or X divided by 3, or maybe it's just going to be X. But there's a great deal of uncertainty around that now, as there must be. The difficulty for the government, and you can see them beginning to grapple with some of this, some aspects of this problem, both here and in the UK. And I suppose, you know, the most obvious aspect of it is this. What point in there is keeping businesses going that have no future? And that will be a really tricky process for the government to navigate. How does it choose which businesses may have a future and which won't? And I don't think that there's going to be any hard decisions on that made in next week's budget. But the funds that are allocated for next year in the budget to achieve those tasks, I'm pretty sure they won't be sufficient to save the entire tourist industry or the entire hospitality industry or whatever. They'll only be sufficient to sustain a part of it. And that really is a problem that nobody in government wants to face, but it will come down the line, certainly. There's no avoiding it.
Jen, I'm going to come back to you in a second with this, but I do want to ask Cliff about that. How does one go about making those decisions? Traditionally, in recessions, like the one that we had a decade ago, there is an element of, I think, what economists call Schumpeterian destruction, where, you know, very often very negative impacts of an economic downturn kind of force issues which were already underlying in the economy, and certain kinds of businesses were in decline anyway, and then they never come back. But this is a very different kind of a situation we're in here right now. It seems to be very difficult to make a decision, an informed decision about, you know, that particular thing is going to have a future and that particular thing isn't.
It's impossible, which is why, as Pat said and as you said, the decision for now is to keep as many boats afloat as you can and see how things look. See how things look next year. I mean, I was listening to there was a programme on last night where Tommy Bowe was going around. I think it was on Virgin Media, talking to various businesses, small businesses, and he went to see Leo Varadkar at the end, the Taoiseach, business minister for business, to kind of put their case to him or whatever, and Taoiseach was explaining to him how he saw things in future, and he said, look, the COVID-19 pub, the pub of the future, is going to be very different, maybe very different to the pub that we're used to in the past. And I think that, you know, it kind of goes to the heart of what we're looking at. And it's really almost impossible to decide from where we stand now what you should do. There is most definitely a case to keep a lot of these sectors going for now. I mean, I was reading a piece in the early days of the crisis about the restaurant industry, for example. Now, the restaurant industry is something which the state would never normally get involved in. If people don't like the Italian restaurant down the end of the road, then they'll go to the Greek one up the far end, and the Italian one will close, and some other operator will take it on and open it. And, you know, that's the normal free market. And the government normally has nothing to do with that, or very little to do with it anyway. There might be a bit of city council support or trying to keep firms going. But in general, it's not a sector that the state gets involved in. But where we are now, the risk is that the entire restaurant industry, half the hotel industry, all the arts industry that, you know, that you write about, a lot of that just gets wiped out. So there is a really big economic argument for keeping those sectors going, because the cost of them all going bust and everyone losing their job and restarting them all again is just enormous. But there does come the point, as Pat said, where you've got to make the call. What's it going to look like in a year or 18 months' time? And it's all just completely down to the virus. If you knew next summer that we were going to be back to something like normal, or even next autumn, then you just keep everything going and you reckon, you know, the costs are going to fall off for you from next summer on. But we just don't know that. We don't even know if it'll be the end of next year. We don't even know if it'll be 2022. We just don't know. So it's going to be the contingency budget. The money's going to be put aside, and a lot of the hard decisions are going to be put off because you just can't make them.
The point is going to come, I think, where the government has to make decisions about shooting the wounded, and that is a politically toxic process to be in that nobody in government wants to address at this point. And they're hoping they won't have to address it. But the chances are, to some degree, they are.
And Jen, that brings up for me the position of the opposition, and obviously Sinn Féin, the leaders of the opposition. There are great potential opportunities for Sinn Féin in this. What Cliff and Pat are describing there are potentially very divisive decisions, decisions in which a lot of people will be hurt, whether they be resentful, they'll be extremely angry. All of that spells opportunity, doesn't it, for the opposition as a whole and Sinn Féin in particular?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Of course, it presents an opportunity. It's the opposition's bread and butter, really, isn't it, to attack the government on issues like that, particularly when you have a situation whereby, and we know we've documented on this podcast very well, the cuts to the pandemic unemployment payment, and the fact that, you know, we were going in one direction towards the summer. There was a lull. The figures were getting lower every week. There was a decrease week on week. And now it's going the opposite direction. And as Cliff mentioned, you know, Micheál Martin talking in the Dáil about an extra 50 or 60,000 people by the end of this week applying for the PUP. And that number is going up every single day that we are in level 3 restrictions. And if you marry this with what Leo Varadkar was talking about last night, which is a circuit breaker lockdown, which is kind of the inevitable if the figures keep going in the wrong direction, you're into level 5 and the figures then are exponential. So, I mean, the government kind of is faced with an impossible situation of having to defend any future cuts or any future tapering of any scheme when they're faced with an opposition like Sinn Féin, who have absolutely no problems in making their voice heard. I mean, we know Mary Lou McDonald's personality very well, and I think that she will make the party's position very well known. And it was interesting as well to hear Leo Varadkar on RTÉ the night when was talking about the decision not to go to level 5. And he kind of raised the spectre of our borrowing limit, that we can't just keep borrowing, that we can't continuously be in this pattern. Yes, we can borrow at very, very low rates at the moment, but that won't be the case always. And also the government are very, very aware of where we stand in comparison to our EU counterparts. They do not want to be seen as being an outlier in the EU, both financially, and all of this ties in because now the economy is so intertwined with the health situation. So, you know, they'll have to balance that situation in terms of providing for people's livelihoods, providing all the various schemes that are needed, but also being able to afford it. And it's much easier, as we all know, to stand on the opposition benches and stand up. and call something a disgrace and highlight the hard cases of workers who are suffering. I think the hard job is making sure the money is there and charting a way through when, as we've already said, the situation is so very uncertain.
Just before we move on to the next subject, I just want to remind our listeners that if you do like this podcast and if you'd like to continue listening to it, and if you'd also like to get unfettered access to the quality journalism published every day and every week by the Irish Times, just go to irishtimes.com/inside. That's where you can sign up for unlimited access. And using that particular address, irishtimes.com/inside, allows us to know how many of you, our listeners, have been persuaded to make that excellent decision, which is very good for the podcast as well for the Irish Times. And if you are in the habit of listening to podcasts, you might be particularly interested in our current offer of a free pair of Sennheiser wireless headphones if you purchase a premium, weekend or complete subscription. All the information is at irishtimes.com/inside. Now, Cliff, at the top of the show, Jen mentioned obviously that Brexit and COVID-19 were at top of the agenda, but she did also mention climate. The Climate Action Bill was passed. That seems to be the only significant other piece of policy which might have some impact on the budget next week.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the best green foot will be put forward in the budget. I think even Eamon Ryan was saying himself that the largest amount of the cost of this will probably accrue in future years rather than this year. But there's no doubt, nonetheless, that a lot of emphasis will be put in the budget on this. I mean, the big cost items looking out over the next few years in terms of what's going to be announced in the climate bill. Number one, wind energy, I think, which is going to require a really chunky kind of 40, 50 billion kind of investment over the next few years. And the other one is retrofitting houses and public buildings, which is going to require something around the same amount of money. Now, we may well see the start of some of that in next week's budget, particularly in terms of the retrofitting programme, perhaps some incentives for people, perhaps a start on some programmes down in the Midlands, which was, I think, highlighted as the place where some of this would start. And the way you do it is to choose blocks of houses and to do it in that way. It seems to be the most cost-effective way rather than doing it across the country. There may be some increased incentive for households as well. And, of course, we will see some other, more than nods to the green agenda, you know, things that have been pushed by the Green Party and were agreed in the programme for government, for example, the walking and cycling infrastructure, investment in public transport. Unlike the last recession, so far anyway, the signs are that investment spending is going to be maintained. That's where we really went wrong last time. So we are going to see a lot of money spent on green items next week. And also on housing.
And housing as well, obviously. But so if we see a rebalancing, let's say, of the transport budget, you know, away to some extent from roads and towards walking, cycling and public transport, do we also see an increase in taxation, in particular carbon tax?
Yeah, there's no doubt the carbon tax is going up. I mean, that's been signalled already. It's going to happen. It's going to happen every year now. And I presume Pascal Donoghue, who is the taxing part of the taxing one of the ministers next week, will underline that. Possible there could be some other moves as well. There were various things outlined in the tax strategy group paper. So the senior public servants sit around every year and discuss what the options for the budget put forward the ministers. Now, typically 80 or 90% of it is completely ignored. But there were some suggestions in the green area. One was this long-standing one of bringing the cost of diesel up to the tax on diesel up to the same level as the tax on petrol, which would be an environmentally sensible thing to do. It hasn't happened the last few years, but there is a proposal that it could happen over a number of years. And given the prices are reasonably low at the pumps at the moment, it wouldn't be the worst time to do that. There's also something the car industry have been giving out about, that there's talk of increasing VRT on petrol and diesel cars, with the most polluting ones getting the highest charge. So we that is a possibility as well. But again, in the teeth of a recession, would you want to do that kind of thing, which could maybe put some jobs at risk? I'm not sure, but they're the kind of areas, in addition to carbon tax, that the government could look at. But no doubt that the carbon tax increase is coming.
Any potential minefields for the government there, Pat? I mean, obviously, it seems to me the Greens have been keeping their heads down a little bit in terms of the things that have been preoccupying most of us. But this is their big moment in terms of some of those issues. There's always been a question about some of the measures particularly the ones that Cliff mentioned there, might play particularly badly in rural Ireland, for example, increasing diesel to a higher rate of tax. Might some of this add to the government's woes over the next couple of months?
Yeah, but I think they will try and take a longer-term view on it. And the long-term view, certainly in the Greens, is that they need obvious budgetary and policy wins, and they need to display them to their members and their voters. The, you know, the plans for the real paradigm shift in terms of energy provision, you know, that massive investment in wind and solar, perhaps wave power as well, that people have been talking about. And certainly, you know, people who may be inclined to vote for the Greens have been talking about that requires massive investment and the potential for massive borrowing to fund that simply has to be hit by the already enormous borrowing that's going on to meet the current costs of the pandemic. But I do think that you'll see lots of eye-catching stuff in terms of public transport, cycling, walking infrastructure. A lot of the there's a political difficulty for the other parties in moving away from roads, or in certainly cancelling roads projects that have already been agreed. And in some cases, the investment has largely been already committed. So I'm not sure you will see high-profile cancellation of roads projects, but you will definitely see some eye-catching stuff on cycling, public transport, and walking. I think that, you know, the potential, going back to your question, the potential for budget landmines, I mean, it's always the horror of finance ministers drawing up, and governments at large drawing up, budgets that something that they haven't quite foreseen explodes that evening or explodes on the following day's live line. And then you will see, as we've seen in time-honoured fashion, the scramble to perform a reverse ferret. But, you know, that's why the green measures in this, I think, will need to be very carefully politically proofed. Now, at one level, there's no proofing of an increase in the carbon tax. That is going to be unpopular in some quarters. I think you'll probably see, you know, mitigation for mitigation measures for some parts of society. You may see, you know, increase in fuel allowance and that for the elderly to compensate for the increased cost of fossil fuels. I mean, that's, of course, counterintuitive, but or contradictory at least, but it is probably politically necessary. So, you know, for some of the green, for some of, you know, those, you know, the green measures that are intended to change lifestyle habits of people, it's hard to politically prove them, because the whole point of them is to make the existing ways of living inconvenient or apply financial penalties to them to encourage people to change their behaviour. But people don't like to change their behaviour. They find that inconvenient. So I think that there is that tension that will definitely remain at the heart of the budget.
Listen, finally, Jen, I'm kind of fascinated by this bill, which was introduced to the Dáil by, I think, by People Before Profit TD Gene O'Kenny first, the Dying with Dignity Bill. It seems to have achieved some level of momentum. It's a complex, ethically difficult subject, one which a lot of countries around the world are starting to deal with in one way or another. I'm sort of surprised that it's got as far as it has, given that it's so challenging. Is it not exactly the kind of thing that in our political system normally gets kicked to committees of the great and good or constitutional conventions or something of that sort?
Well, that's the big question this week, I think. And it is, you're right, it is a highly, it's a really, really sensitive topic. And I think the politicians are very well aware of it. And it's back up for debate this week. It was only tabled a number of weeks ago. It's proceeding to committee stage. So the government did table an amendment, I think, last Thursday, when it was first presented for a second reading. And really, it was a counter motion from the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee. And what the government wanted to do, what the amendment proposes to do, is that the bill is read a second time in 12 months' time, October 2021. And what that allows for is a scrutiny between now and then by a specially established, by an all-party Oireachtas committee. And that Oireachtas committee would then set out recommendations, which then would be considered in turn by the Oireachtas again. So, you know, if that amendment is agreed, then obviously the bill doesn't go ahead to the next reading or to the next stage. And, you know, I think there would be a lot of disappointment from Jean O'Kelly, because, you know, he was keen to point out that this to him is kicking the can down the road. Whereas those on the other side of the fence say, because it's such a sensitive bill, because it's such a sensitive topic, it does need to be thrashed out, perhaps in an arena that isn't as hot-tempered sometimes as the Dáil can become. And we saw with the issue of the Eighth Amendment that Oireachtas committees can play a very constructive role and allow politicians and, you know, other interested parties to thrash out an issue in a less charged atmosphere. So we'll see what way the vote goes. But you know, it will be one. It'll definitely be one to keep an eye on. But for the time being, it has the support, and at least in the stage of moving to the next part of parties like Sinn Féin and other parties on the left.
I mean, this is an instance where it does make sense, doesn't it, for added scrutiny, Pat?
Yeah, but of course, the whole purpose of the legislative process is to scrutinise legislation. This is an attempted kick to touch by the government. That may be a terribly sensible thing to do, depending on your view on the issue, I suppose. The vote is actually taking place tonight. The weekly votes previously used to be scheduled to take place on a Thursday. But this vote, because it all is in the convention centre and all TDs can vote in it, this vote is taking place tonight. Sometime between 9:30 and a quarter past 10. So we will know what the situation is with regard to it fairly quickly. I did a bit of ringing around on it earlier. People in government buildings who have, as Jen correctly says, have proposed the amendment to it, which would pause it for a year and kick it into a special committee. They're quite unsure as to how this vote is going to go. They definitely don't know. There was very little confidence that the bill would, that the government's amendment would be approved by the Dáil earlier. Both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael will operate a vote of conscience on it. There's not going to be any whip on it, so that makes it inherently unpredictable. Similarly with the Greens, though cabinet ministers who in whose name the government amendment is tabled will be expected to vote for the government amendment. Labour is going to vote against the government amendment. Sinn Féin is going to vote against the government amendment and for the bill. And so I think at this point, the fate of the bill is very much up in the air. So we'll see later whether the bill dies with dignity or whether it lives to fight another day, as it were.
Perhaps an ill-chosen metaphor, but we will leave it there. Anyway, thanks to Pat, to Jen, and to Cliff. Thanks also to our producer, Suzanne Brennan, JJ Vernon, our engineer. And if you do want to get in touch with us, we're always delighted to hear from you. Just email us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.